Today we're going to have another very interesting show. We are continuing on the path of looking at the world at large, and this time through the lens of Carl Frankel, who is the author of this book, Out of the Labyrinth. Who we are, how we go wrong, and what we can do about it. We all, at this point, need solutions, in fact, fast, straightforward solutions, to dealing with the world crises that are facing us on all levels, psychologically and emotionally, as well as physically, environmentally, and economically. Environment is a huge issue for us all, and Carl deals with this rather deftly in this book, and he'll be speaking with us about the applications of his ideas, very well thought out ideas, that can, I feel, assist us in looking at and do something about our current situation. Hi, Carl.
Delighted to be here.
Good to have you.
Thanks, Mitchell.
Now, your background is as an environmental lawyer.
Well,
is that
I was trained
among
as a,
other things.
I was trained as a lawyer, but I never actually practiced environmental law. I got the writing bug fairly early in my life, and was a business writer for a number of years. And I just felt like my life was schizophrenic. I had all this passion about helping to create a better world, and then all the writing was about making money. So, about 17 years ago, I decided to find a path that would allow me to combine my passion with my talents and skills, and so I started writing and about environmental issues, and it turned into writing about sustainability, with this particular focus on business and sustainability. But the more you look at these issues, the big higher up the mountain you have to climb to understand what's going on. So my interests have evolved over the years from, you know, what's Procter & Gamble doing about this product, to what's really going on here, and how do we understand this weird situation we're in, and how do we make sense of who we are in a world that increasingly tries to make things confusing for us?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I have the sneaky suspicion when I look a little more closely than at other times, they're trying to kill us.
Well, I think spiritually they're... I think that might be a bit of an overstatement because it's too conscious. I mean, in Iraq, I think it's overt, but in our lives, there's such a thing as called a control mythology, and there's certain assumptions about who we are that are embedded in the culture. And in many ways, these assumptions about who we are life-destroying. So in that sense, I think you're completely right, but it's not... We have lots of excuses and reasons to be paranoid. I prefer to not go down that road and put the blame on a sort of general mood or stain in our culture rather than conscious malevolent intention
exactly.
On the part of
I don't think
the
it's
Trilateral
malice.
Commission or whatever.
That's right. And actually, that's not what I meant. What I meant is that I feel that we have an addiction, a generic addiction to destruction as distinct from creation. As a general nature of humans, that we tend to do things that are to our detriment, and therefore we allow the corporate structure to do things like use certain kinds of preservatives in our foods, or genetically engineer the food chain, and all sort of chemicals instead of natural.
I think
become allowable.
Freud talked about this, about the thanatos, the death instinct, and that's clearly present. I don't look at it that way particularly. It's not that it's not valid. It's not my focus. My focus is more on the different conflicts inside ourselves. And to use myself as an example, I, like everybody in the world, go through life, and one part of me wants to open and embrace all experience, but I'm a person whose instincts are for self-preservation, like every person's, like every animal's. And so there are places where I'm going to want to control my environment, close down, distance myself from negative emotions, and do all that kind of controlling behavior. Mm-hmm. It's simply hardwired into us as animals.
Definitely.
So
from a survival point of view.
And what this book that I've written is about the conflict that happens between that part of us that, or this is a piece of what I write about, that part of us that is willing to surrender to the miracle, really, of being on this planet and submit, if not necessarily to a higher power, to the simply the our own powerlessness. And then there's another part of us that needs to be in charge and be on top in order to give us a sense of power. And, you know, neither is fully true or false. Maybe theologically the former is more real. But the fact is we do control a lot of stuff. I mean, just look at what people are doing to the planet. We control, to our detriment, things that are going on. And what happens is that organizations like corporations become created in the mold of one of these sub-personalities. In the book, I have there are three sub-personalities. The controller, what we're calling the controller here, I call the strategist, because it's really how do I achieve my goals as quickly and efficiently as I can. The person who is surrendering to the all, if you will, is the seeker, the person who tries to find meaning in this mystery that we've been dumped into on this planet. And then the citizen is the person who interacts with other people in the natural world.
The social nature.
Being. And I am right now being a citizen in the limited sense of I'm in conversation with you, so I'm engaging you and engaging the natural world. So the world can be seen, what the structures of culture and organizations and interpersonal relations can be seen as a conversation among these three personalities. Corporations are the quintessential strategic organization. They are about control. You know, if you don't predict and deliver on your predictions, you're out of a job. And so
if the corporation as a whole doesn't deliver on its products or services,
absolutely. So
it's out of
it's high risk
market
and,
share.
And you've got to control and you've got to win. It's a Darwinian, old social Darwinist model. And you know, and to some extent it's a reality that we're all in it. The challenge becomes to honor all these aspects of ourselves and not to be negative about one or the other, but really try to develop a dance where we really honor all three aspects of ourselves.
Truly.
The seeker, the strategist, and the citizen all have crucial places in our bodies, in our body minds, and in our broader culture. And what happens is that as a culture we play favorites big time with the strategist and it comes to be perceived as kind of an instrumentality of death, as you, in a way, and its impacts not because the strategist is bad, but because it's
how
imbalanced.
It's being used.
It's how it's being used, and it's out of balance with the rest. Creates a really dysfunctional culture and a dysfunctional, what some people call reality tunnel, a dysfunctional sense of
Robert Anton Wilson.
Yeah, exactly.
sense One of my favorites too.
And mine too. So, sense of who we are in the world. So. These are subtle and deep issues, but I think they're ones that we need to unearth if we're really going to have seriously useful conversations about our future.
Agreed. As you move on in the book, you talk about something called the integrity way, the integral way.
Right.
And by the way, I just want to say that the book is almost like a nonfiction Ulysses. It is mythic in proportion, and its meaning and its potential value, if recognized. I mean, I know that I kept thinking, before you made reference to Ken Wilber in the book, that you are walking along a certain pathway, so similar, traveling that same road as of offering people of high mind and deep heart a chance to follow a certain pathway that might really lead to solutions, because it asks for a real broad-mindedness and a real rational but heartfelt way of relating to the world.
Well, thank
you. And I very much appreciate it.
Well, it's very kind of you. One of the things that I tried to do when I wrote this book, there are these three characters, and there's this, and the way we integrate them and balance them is at a higher level, and that's the integral way.
Correct.
But I figured if I was going to write a book that was about being a citizen and engaging our responsibility in the world, about searching for meaning, and about the power of our stories that give us meaning, and about the desperate need for accelerated, effective strategies, I should write a book whose form imitated and mimicked and represented and embodied the substance of what I was writing about. So it made it for a challenge to write, but I really wanted to write a book that had was a personal story, that had a narrative line, that had an intellectual line, and that had a civic line. And, and that was part of my challenge. And the thing about Wilbur that I'll mention is that when I first read Wilbur, which was probably over 10 years ago now, the first book I read was his Opus, and reading it was like,
which?
I wrote this book.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, but he had the words, right? I mean, so he was really very influential for me. It was a very powerful experience reading him. I do believe that this book is very different in important ways, but I would not contest the fact that I am plowing the same fields that he's plowed.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
And there is a confluence as well.
Definitely.
I really see that. What I'd like to do, Carl, is to sort of have you articulate the idea of the integral way via an example of, like, take, like you just mentioned Procter & Gamble, just as an example.
Right.
It doesn't matter what corporation, but you see on the micro level a corporation is doing, interacting with its environment and marketplace in a way that, let's say, we would call detrimental and non-sustainable.
Right.
If someone were to get hold of the book at the top and say, my word, let's see how we could create a sustainable model, not do harm, and, you know, the old Hippocratic idea, and see how we can really create a model that was environmentally friendly and, you know, human friendly.
It's an interesting question, and I will try to do it justice. It's not easy because I have to go into it at some depth, but let me just put it this way.
And keep it simple.
And keep it simple, right, and keep it simple. Conventionally, businesses are all about strategy. They're all about the bottom line, and that's what they focus on. And now this new beast has come along called social responsibility. You're supposed to be civically responsible. You're supposed to be a good citizen. This is great stuff. But it misses an important piece of the equation, and this is why I think sustainability has a missing link that hasn't really been explored, and that is about this meaning dimension, this delivering... Addressing issues of consciousness, really, there is also a control mythology that corporations impose on everybody who is within the reach of their advertising, marketing, and worldview, and this is sort of treated as not on the table. So sure, McDonald's will open a Ronald McDonald House. That's a good, socially responsible activity. Meanwhile, it's making food products and creating a culture that's very dubious and in denial, basically, about the cultural and consciousness impacts of its advertising and of its fast food modality and all that stuff. So what do you need?
Products.
And it's products, yeah. And so what would it look like? It would look, an integral approach would entail a McDonald's senior management saying, look, we have to sell product, we have financial responsibility to our stakeholders, and we're also committed to our communities, but we have to look at the whole picture. We have to look at the meaning dimension and our impacts on people's meaning systems. So by way of supporting diversity of consciousness, diversity of meaning system, every time we open a franchise in a developing country, we will put $100,000 into a fund for cultural diversity or to support slow food. In other words, it would acknowledge and embrace the need for cultures that were not McDonald's-centric and sort of a mono-Mac culture, if you will.
Right.
And that is an example of the sorts of things. Now, you can't reasonably expect a McDonald's to do it. I think there's a somewhat greater chance that a dozen companies, leading companies, could get together and say, the world's going in the wrong place and people hate us. At least a lot of people hate us. What can we do about this? And what you do about it is you start speaking the truth. You start speaking the truth about what's actually going on, and the truth is, we are in a culture war and a consciousness war to a significant degree, and we have to come up with strategies that work for us and our needs, but that also acknowledge and honor the people on the other side of the equation who are being disadvantaged, hurt, harmed, or full of rage or hatred about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do? And as the leaders of our society, for better or worse, it's in our ballpark to step forward. The analogy is of a dysfunctional family where the father is an alcoholic or something. You only create change when the father steps forward and says, okay, I cop, let's deal with this as a system and see how the whole thing's going wrong. And in many ways, our corporations are like the big daddies in our dysfunctional global culture, and they're the ones who really have to step forward to make change happen. Otherwise, it's just like the kids hollering and going, pay attention to me, Daddy, or, you know, or having symptoms because Dad's not delivering the goods.
Exactly. It seems to me that there has to be a way that there is a win-win scenario that can emerge.
The presumption in this book is that there are, and what happens is that people really get locked into their own worldviews or reality tunnels without even realizing they're into it. And I'll give you another example of this that I talk about in the book. I attended a meeting in Boston maybe 4 years ago. It was put on by a nonprofit that specialized in education for sustainability, and the issue was the same one we deal with all the time, which is how do you make change happen quickly? Not only do we need change, but we have to accelerate change. And as I watch, and they invited people from a number of different fields and disciplines. There are business people there, there are politicians and, you know, PR people there, and there are also people who are spoke for voluntary simplicity movement and that kind of thing. And what happened was the business, and three arguments started emerging. Folks said, you people's make it make economic sense. You've got to show them rationale, you know, cognitive therapy. You know, they'll get you, just let it make sense. We have people who will recognize new interests. The voluntary simplicity folks were saying, this is about a conversion. People get it or they don't. Ever or get people go to work. Yes, they just rock it. It's a gut thing.
Bill, right, our company's doing well. We can distribute some wealth. We're still living fine. We're driving a Prius instead. You know,
right?
Dream on. But you know, we're all doing well, and yet we're distributing the wealth another way, and we're not hurting the end user either. So there's more money in his pocket at the end of the day as well, and all is well. That becomes more of a win-win situation. What do you think?
It's another one of those questions that opens up to about five answers, and my five selves have five different views of it. Right? No, three selves, whatever.
Okay.
But the basic of it is, sure, it's great if people aren't greedy. Unnecessary greed, gratuitous greed, comes out of a sense of holding and lack of faith and a need to, like, protect oneself.
It's fear-based,
and it's sad, and it's pervasive. That's clearly not
true,
useful. And to the extent that...
Enron.
Right, and to the extent that people just do away with that and move somewhere else, I think that's great. But there's another side to the story. It's an open question, first, how many people will actually do this if you're looking to make the world a better place. And it's also, it's not necessarily the right solution for the following reason. There's this whole movement called socially responsible business, as you know. I applaud it, and yet a guy I've been in touch with recently said he has a real problem with it because it's simply, it's a palliative. It's not sufficient to address the problem. It's a kind of, I mean, he views it sort of as a puritanical appeasement of guilt, and it's not necessarily that, but the critical thing here is that it gets in the way of system change. What you need to do at a more fundamental level is redesign enterprise so that the rules of the game support and favor what is known as social enterprise, where the practices of business and a truly social mission are married in ways they're not in our contemporary business environment. Socially responsible business, as currently constituted, is a soft and nice variation on the current business model. And if people use that as their aspiration, as their end goal, the potential for change gets limited by virtue of the lack of vision, ultimately, that's being brought to that. So I don't mean this as a criticism by any stretch of the imagination for the people who are doing this, but it's a reality tunnel that can create blinders to the alternative, which is, how do we go about building a kind of new story about capitalism and new rules of engagement for capitalism that marry the two, the profit motive and social enterprise, in a much more dynamic, dramatic, and effective way? And it's just not a coincidence completely that I'm completing a paper right now on that subject. So it's a subject that's near and dear to my heart. I'm also in the process of putting together a social enterprise that will produce, is not going to tithe, it's not committing to tithe, but it will produce profits, theoretically, and it will be left open to the owners whether the owners get the profits, but the mission or not, or something else gets it. If it's something else that gets it, it will be the local economy that we want to support. And how do you find out if we're being true to our social mission or greedy bastards? Well, you have stakeholders in the community who judge you. And if you say, if I were to do this and I had cancer or something and I needed the money, then I would say, look, I need this for this personal emergency, right? And they would probably say yes. Mm-hmm. But it's accountability and transparency that can step into business rather than have a policy of we give 10% of profits. Maybe it's a terrible business decision to give 10% of profits to away from you.
Right.
So what you need is new models of business that do the same thing.
And are flexible, you're saying.
That are flexible,
that are resilient.
But are resilient and ultimately more powerful and effective. That's why I said it was a long answer to a short question.
No, it's good. I had an idea of redesigning. In fact, I really started to write this up.
Right.
Redesign the definition of a corporation.
Right.
And that the definition and the charge of the board of directors was not simply to maximize profit to the shareholders.
Right.
That was not it.
Right.
It was to yield a profit, to assure a profit to the best of its ability, while making sure that all the activities of the corporation were sustainable, that were humane to its own employees as well as in the products and services that they deliver. And you had certain hallmarks, if you will, of environmental sustainability and humanitarian factors that would have to be met by definition of a successful corporation. So by so doing, redefining success.
And even
profit, for that matter.
And in academia, there's a lot of work around this. Milton Friedman is the guy who is the person who's most famous for espousing the shareholder theory, which is make as much money as you can for your shareholders, and anything else is a drag on the corporation, and it will drag society down because it's a lack of specialization and it's a blurring of duties and obligations. The most effective society is one where everybody, the nonprofits help people and business creates jobs. That was his theory. And
that is so dinosaur-like.
Well, it is dinosaur-like, but he is the epitome of this worldview, uh-huh. and it's actually called shareholder theory. And counter to this is something called stakeholder theory, which basically says that businesses are not only accountable to the people who own the company, they are accountable to everybody they do business with or have relationships with. So every stakeholder is a virtual owner. And that's what you're saying, and this is the theory that's coming to pass. And what's interesting about globalization is I defy you, if I'm running a little auto repair store in Mexico that's keeping gas guzzlers on the road, everybody in the world is being affected by my actions. So in today's world,
it's
the butterfly effect. Everybody is a stakeholder of even the smallest mom and pop company. So if we were to update organizations to meet the realities of our world, it creates Friedman, it just falls into the dustbin of history. So there's a great battle now about how do we revision business and how do we set up new rules of the road so that businesses are actually supported and incentivized to conform to these new realities rather than just to pretend they're not there, which is the way it usually works.
Yes, exactly. Okay. It seems, I mean, a good part or an organic part of this happening is the emergence of the seeker.
Interesting that you say that.
You know, I just began thinking, Carl, about what Europe was like 50 years ago. No, 25 years ago. I mean, I lived in France for a while. I lived even in Switzerland, and I saw there was this idea of the siesta.
Right.
In France. I don't mean just Spain and Italy and Greece. Right. And that means the family took time off. Now they're all workaholics like we are in the United States.
Right.
Maniacal. So, I mean, it was just 25 years ago that, you know, why is it that we can't, and I believe truly that we can, instill that sensibility again?
Well, I'm with you all the way.
Because it's just around the corner. It just happened, you know?
I just finished writing a column for a magazine I write called Green at Work, and it's about if you have a slow food movement to counter fast food, why not a slow business movement?
Yeah,
you get deep relationships, where you don't try to do 1,000 things, and you just focus, and enough is enough, and...
Right.
You know, that's the way you do it. So.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting.
Right.
The timing of that is interesting. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's a multitasking, octopus tasking.
Right. I wrote that between the 12 other articles and columns that I write.
Yeah, exactly. And,
you know,
exactly.
Right.
But, I mean, it just seems like that's one of the aspects that needs to come emerge to the surface. And
absolutely,
you know,
right.
And interestingly and ironically, you know, we're talking about the destructive, and then you mentioned right. Thanatos of Freud's right. idea, and all. But it's by the remembrance of death that could help to throw and spring people back into life. I mean, it's an old spiritual right. idiom, you know, right. and theme. And, you know, by watching destruction happen, it makes people kind of wake up and want to say, wait a minute,
well,
let's
you think about
9/11,
there are two possible yeah. alternatives. It either puts people deeper into their shells, which is what has happened with the support of the Bush administration, enthusiastic support, or it can wake people up. I mean, it is true. It's a kind of a basic tenet of the eternal wisdom that you know, death through death life. And that's exactly. clearly a part of it. But it's one of the great challenges of our time because we're surrounded by images of death.
Exactly. We've done really a beautiful job with this book. I mean, I feel like you've positioned us in a way that I think if more business leaders were actually to pay some attention to and just kick around, there's real juice in it, you know. And
well, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it.
What's next?
Well, there are a number of things. I obviously have multiple channels in my life. So without talking about the seven other channels in my fast business mode,
yeah.
I basically want to talk to people about the material in the book. I want to go out and share with this and dialogue with people. When I talk with people about the material, people pay attention. There are different ways people can listen to you. And sometimes if you give people a heady idea, you can feel them sort of listening with their head. And this material engages people from a different place, and it's
yes.
they're powerful conversations, and I want to have these conversations.
Exactly. In fact, I dare say they are mythic.
Well, these are mythic times.
They really are. They really are. Thanks a lot for coming and
thank you very much.
Sharing with us.
I really appreciate it.
And good luck with your work, because it is impacting us all.
Thank you very much.
Butterfly effect and everything.
Thank you.
This is Mitchell J. Raven for A Better World. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And see how the ideas of these that Carl has espoused here can really help us really make a better world. Thanks again for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you all next week.